This is All In. I'm Miriam Sob. Today we're talking about misinformation and conspiracy theories with psychology and media experts. If you have questions or comments on our show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. You can also send us a digital voice message with our smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop. Just look for it in your phone's app store. With us live now from Brussels is Stephen Lewandowski, chair in cognitive psychology at the University of Bristol. Welcome, Stephen. Thank you so much for staying up late to join us today.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, wow, so much to talk about. And I know you're an expert in so many different areas on this. So we'll start with something simple first here. What are you most interested in learning right now about misinformation and conspiracy theories?
Well, obviously, what I'm most interested in is how we can sort of get them under control. And I personally think that what we have to look at is we have to understand the social media landscape and the social media business model, which I think is in part at least responsible for what we're seeing now. And one of the reasons I'm in Brussels at the moment is because I'm working with the European Commission to think about ways in which we might improve the online environment and make it more compatible with deliberative democracy than it is now at the moment. At the moment, what happens is that pretty much everything online is geared towards capturing your attention. If you go online, be it Facebook or Twitter or any other social media, it's all about your attention. That is what is being sold to advertisers. That is what's being monetized. Now, if you have an economy where attention is the only commodity of interest, then it would be miraculous indeed if that economy gave rise to quality information. Well, guess what? It doesn't, because things that attract attention tend to be new and novel and outrageous. And of course, that is precisely what conspiracy theories and disinformation is all about. And that, I think, is where the core of the problem lies.
Speaking of social media and how, you know, things have to capture your attention, I often wonder, is there a limit on how outrageous something can be? Because it seems like you have to, like, raise the bar every time on how to get someone to click on something. Is there a limit?
Well, that's a very good question. I sometimes wonder myself, 5 years ago, if somebody said to me that, you know, there'll be a serious discussion about whether or not the earth is flat on social media, I would have said, well, no way. I mean, that is just too far out. And yet that is precisely what is happening now. There are some people out there who succumb to that particular belief, which, of course, we know to be false. And one of the interesting reasons why this can happen is because what social media does for the first time in human history is to allow people to connect across vast distances. And what that implies is that any belief, no matter how absurd, can find a community online that in reality you would never find. In the 19th century or even the early 20th century, if I had thought the earth was flat, no one in my village or neighborhood would have believed that. Today, I can jump on Facebook and I can find others who think like that, even though there are just a tiny number of people dispersed around the world. Now, one consequence of people believing that their beliefs are shared by others is that we become resistant to correction. So the more I think other people share my views, the less likely I am to change my views. And that is another novelty that social media has introduced that we've never had to contend with before.
Right, right. And so I wonder, you know, as you've been looking into this and studying this, are there any specific areas around sort of the psychology behind these issues that people are still trying to understand in the research realm? Is there anything still mysterious about how it is that people succumb to some of these ideologies?
Well, that's a very good question, because in a sense, we do know a lot about why that happens. For example, we do know why some people are susceptible to conspiracy theories. And we know that in a pandemic in particular, whenever people feel that they've lost control over their lives, when they're scared, when they don't know what to do to cope with a risk, under those circumstances, we know that people become more susceptible to conspiracy theories. That's been the case for centuries. We know that from previous pandemics. So pandemics are a factory that is cranking out people who believe in conspiracy theories for psychological reasons that are well understood, because believing in a conspiracy can offer people a sense of comfort. If I can blame everything that happens in the world on, you know, Bill Gates or George Soros or Al Gore or somebody, whoever it is, then that gives me the ability to think the world might be different if that person hadn't been so evil. And some people derive psychological comfort from that ability. They find that easier to take than to accept the fact that the pandemic can arrive at random from a bat in China.
Mm-hmm. And is it also that it offers people sort of a sense of control? I don't know if it's human nature where we want to have control over our environment.
Oh, yes, there's no question. I mean, and we can, in laboratory experiments, we can turn that on and off. If you deny people control, they become more likely to detect pattern in random dots where there is no pattern. And that is precisely what a conspiracy theory is. It is basically a pattern detection when, in fact, we're just talking about random events. And lack of control is causing that. Mm-hmm. And giving people control, we also know, is attenuating that risk. So anything we can do right now to give people a sense of control is going to be a positive move towards reducing the influence of conspiracy theories.
Mm-hmm. And now that I'm thinking about it, with social media, does that maybe increase people's feeling of lack of control in some instances? Because you might post something, but you don't know what's going to become of it.
Well, that's a good point. I never thought of that before. But yes, I mean, so social media give us control? Well, I don't know. I mean, I spend a lot of time on social media. I find it rewarding because I learn a lot. You know, if you follow scientists on Twitter, you learn a lot from their publications. I suspect it's not giving me a greater sense of control. So that's a good possibility.
Yeah. I mean, I have so much interest in social media and seeing where it's going. You know, I was one of those early adopters way back in the day, and I've seen the changes. So yes, I could talk about this forever. But I do want to get back to talking a little bit about misinformation. How would you define that term? And is there a difference between misinformation and disinformation?
Yeah, very good question. Well, first of all, psychologically, I think any misinformation, which is simply information that turns out to be false after you first believe it, any such information psychologically is probably functioning in a very similar way. And what we know about such misinformation is that if you tell people something is wrong after they first believe it, they will, on the one hand, tell you, oh, yeah, I know, you told me that's wrong. But on the other hand, in a different context, when we're asking them to make use of information in a reasoning task, for example, they will still rely on the false information. And we call that the continued influence effect. And that is an incredibly robust and replicated finding. You know, people will accept a correction. They'll say, yeah, I know that's false. And then they're going to use that information 10 or 20 seconds later in a different context. And that's what makes it problematic, because corrections don't always work. Now, disinformation is also misinformation, but by my definition, it comes with the additional intent to deceive. Disinformation is something that is produced by people who do it for political or economic purposes, or just to, you know, satisfy their own emotional needs, but with intent to deceive. And so online, I think we get a mix of both. There is a lot of misinformation out there that's kind of incidental. People didn't know it was wrong. But then there's also disinformation out there that is being spread, mainly mm-hmm. for political reasons.
So I guess what you're saying is that misinformation is sort of unintentional, and whereas disinformation is very intentional with some kind of goal in mind.
Precisely. Mm-hmm.
And so what is the difference between a conspiracy theory and misinformation? I mean, can those kind of coincide together?
Well, in fact, they almost necessarily do. I mean, conspiracy theories, by definition, because they're theories other than actual conspiracies, they're based on misinformation or disinformation. Now, that doesn't mean that every form of disinformation is a conspiracy theory. For example, when Donald Trump claimed that more people attended his inauguration than any other inauguration in history, well, that was plain false. I mean, it was totally false. But it wasn't a conspiracy theory. So you can be misleading without engaging in a conspiracy theory. Now, how do we detect a conspiracy theory? Well, it turns out that there is a catalog of reasons, a catalog of symptoms of the cognition of people who believe in conspiracy theories that we can exploit to determine whether somebody is engaging in conspiratorial rhetoric. And one marker that I particularly like is the incoherence of conspiracy theories. You know, there are people who say that COVID is a hoax and doesn't kill anyone. But in the next sentence, half a second later, they say, oh, it's a Chinese bioweapon that was designed to kill us all. Well, come on, either it's harmless or it's going to kill us. It can't be, you know, it can't be both. And that sort of incoherence is typical of conspiracy theories. And that's, in fact, one of the things we can teach people in some of our experiments to, train them so they can detect when they're being misled and they become less susceptible to misinformation.
All right. Well, I'd like to learn more about those experiments when we come back. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with our guest. And we're talking about misinformation and conspiracy theories. If you have questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soeb. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. We're talking today about misinformation and conspiracy theories to find out how much impact it's having on culture and politics in Indiana, the U.S., and around the world. Before the break, we were speaking with Stephen Lewandowski, chair in cognitive psychology at the University of Bristol, and we started delving into a little bit about some of the experiments that you're working on. Stephen, can you tell us about something that you're seeing right now in any of your experiments on this process, and how, I guess, are you able to get people off of the conspiracy thinking path?
Yeah, well, there's a number of things we're doing right now. And to me, right now, the most promising avenue is through something called inoculation. And it is just like a medical inoculation, a vaccination. What we do is we're trying to protect people against being misled by vaccinating them or inoculating them cognitively. And so basically, the basic idea is that what we do is we expose people to a weakened dose of the misleading information together with an explanation of why that is misleading and how they can spot it and how they can become resistant to that. And so my colleagues at Cambridge, Sander van der Linden and John Rosenbeek and I have a whole series of experiments where we show that we can train people in less than 2 minutes in a brief video. We can train them to identify typical ways in which misinformation is presented. I mentioned incoherence, and indeed we can train people in a 2 minute video to spot incoherence. And then in comparison to a control condition where they didn't get any such video, people are more likely to detect misleading information. They're less likely to believe it, and they're less likely, and that's very important, they're less likely to share it. And we can target different aspects of misinformation. We can, you know, warn people against exaggerated emotions. You know, one of the ways in which people mislead is by being very emotive, because they know that emotion, especially negative emotion, attracts attention. So we can teach people. We can just say, hey, you know, if you get really angry after you read something or really outraged, have another careful look. Maybe they're playing with you. Maybe there are people who are trying to mislead you or get you excited or outraged. And so there's a whole smorgasbord of these various different things we can teach people. And so far, pretty much every time we try it, it works like a charm. It does make it less likely that people are being misled.
So it sounds like that might be the future of educating folks, getting them to watch these types of things before engaging in social media or other avenues.
Indeed. And it could just become part of social media. You know, it can become a public service message that is just being presented to you just like any other ad. And, you know, we make sure that our videos are kind of entertaining and funny and, you know, attract, keep people's attention. Yeah. So that's certainly one way to go. There's also other work out there, for example, by Sam Weinberg at Stanford, who is teaching high school students how to assess whether or not a website is likely to be accurate. And it turns out that you can teach kids to become better at this. And the key insight is what's called lateral reading. And this is what fact checkers do. They don't spend time looking at a website that they're trying to evaluate. They go laterally. That means they're opening a whole bunch of other tabs and they're searching for information about the website from elsewhere. And the moment you do that, you know, if you're looking at a hoax website, it'll show up in Snopes or the New York Times will have a debunk or somebody else will. And then you can instantly say, aha, well, that's probably not very reliable. And that works much better than staring at a website trying to figure out how good it is by just looking at it. You got to look elsewhere. And we can teach people in the classroom to get better at that. So I think that is, you know, definitely an aspect of combating misinformation. And in Finland, it turns out, that has worked remarkably well, because there in high school, dealing with misinformation is part of the curriculum. And that's one prong. Now, I'm concerned, though, about saying that's all we have to do, because that's putting it all onto the consumer. And I think that's wrong. We also have to consider, as I said at the very beginning, we have to consider the business model of social media and the attention economy and the reinforcement structure that's out there. Because at the moment, the way the attention economy works, the more outrageous the content is that is being presented by social media, the more money they're going to make. Now, that, I think, is a real problem, and we have to address that somehow.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I mean, I've myself become very disillusioned with social media in the sense that, you know, I've found, you know, I can game the algorithm by putting something dramatic, and then all of a sudden everybody sees it. But the more important stuff is always lost in the shuffle. So it becomes frustrating. And then there's the argument about this pay-to-play model. Like, if you pay more money, now your stuff will be visible. And there's also questions about access and, you know, all of that. But, you know, we have a listener question wanting to know, how do you handle people who believe in conspiracy theories? Is that the million-dollar question?
It's the million-dollar question. And if you pay me $1 million, I'll probably answer it. Well, basically, the important thing is to differentiate between different audiences. Now, it turns out, I've done some work on this, it turns out that very often people will engage in conspiratorial rhetoric, not because they actually believe this, but as a rhetorical device to get them off the hook. So let me give you an example. If I want to fly to Bali for a holiday, assuming I can do this again after the pandemic, well, the easiest way not to feel guilty about that is to just say climate change is a hoax. And then you're off the hook. You can fly to Bali. You can buy a big SUV or a gas-guzzling truck, anything you want. It's irrelevant because climate change is a hoax. Now, I have data to suggest that you know, a lot of people do that. You know, and it works. You're off the hook. You don't have to worry about it. If you're a smoker and you say all the doctors are in on this conspiracy called lung cancer, well, then you can keep smoking, right? Problem solved. Mm-hmm. Now, that's what many people do who articulate conspiracy theories. And those people, it turns out, are actually within limits, susceptible to correction and discussion if you can get them to pay attention to you. Of course, that's always a prerequisite. So in a classroom or a conversation, you can be quite successful with those people. Having said that, there is another set of people who seriously believe these conspiracy theories and for whom they have become part of their identity. And for them, it's going to be extremely difficult to find any way to sort of convince them otherwise, unless you're investing a huge amount of time and you're really engaging in a process that is almost therapeutic. And the only literature we have that explains that is dealing with de-radicalization of terrorists and so on, because, you know, you're talking about some hardcore committed believers in a cult, effectively, and it's very right. difficult. But the encouraging thing is that that is a relatively small number, and there's a much larger number of people who sort of, you know, say things but don't actually believe it to that extent. And most importantly, what I think is the most important audience are people who don't believe in conspiracy theories. And this gets us back to inoculation. If you can talk to the public at large and you can explain to them why people believe in conspiracy theories, it's because they lose control and they're afraid, and then explain how that expresses itself, for example, through incoherence, then you can protect people in the public at large against being sort of drawn into the same rabbit hole.
Mm-hmm. And I like how you touched upon sort of the cult-like mentality that permeates in some of these conspiracy circles or just in the way people think. It made me think, you know, is it hard sometimes for people to let go of stuff, even if you're giving them all of the logical explanations and they know it's logical, but the unlearning and the leaving that behind is just so difficult?
Oh, absolutely. If you're that, you know, if you're committed and if it's become part of your identity and part of your social surroundings, then that is extremely difficult. Undoubtedly, and requires patience and empathy and understanding, but understanding without giving ground. I mean, you know, I can understand as an intellectual why people might deny climate change, but that doesn't mean I'm going to cede ground and say, yeah, you got a point. Well, no, they don't have a point. Mm-hmm. The science is unequivocal. But so you got to find a very fine balance between being clear on what is reality while at the same time acknowledging that some people have difficulty with that.
Mm-hmm. And when we talk about sort of the pandemic and the misinformation that's been spreading around that, do you see a difference in how the misinformation is spread depending on where in the world it is? Are there certain countries where it's more pervasive or is it pretty much even across the board?
Excellent question. When it comes to vaccinations, I can answer the question with data. And basically, it turns out that the larger the share of votes for populist parties, the greater the vaccine hesitancy is in a country. So there's been some recent research showing that across European countries, that the more people vote for populists, the more people will reject vaccinations. Now, that was data from before the pandemic, but I have no reason to think that's changed because populism, this idea, you know, that they're the virtuous people who are opposing this corrupt elite, that idea, which in the United States was encapsulated by Donald Trump, that idea is based on emotion alone and is antithetical to evidence, as we have seen during Trump's presidency and his record of inaccuracy. And that is generally true. So the moment you're handing over politics or society to people who are out of their ideology, not willing to accept evidence, the moment that happens, then, you know, everything becomes much, much more difficult because evidence-based reasoning is then denigrated and cast aside, as we have seen during the pandemic in the United States.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to battling sort of that misinformation, especially when you mentioned these vaccines, do you think that it helps when there's like a big media push and public figures are getting the vaccine and saying, look, I took it, it's safe? Does that help at all?
Yes, I think it does. I mean, of course, any kind of message, any kind of influencers who are, you know, putting out that message is helpful. It's also helpful, we know that from data, to remind people of the scientific consensus. That is that virtually all doctors will say that vaccinations have saved more lives than any other medical invention in history. You know, that sort of positive message, getting that out is extremely important. It's also important to focus people's perceptions on the risks of the disease they're trying to avoid. You know, at the moment, a lot of people here in Europe are talking about these rare blood clots that come with the AstraZeneca vaccine. Possibly, we're not sure. But, you know, I mean, those are extremely rare events. And, you know, your risk of dying from COVID is far greater than your risk of developing that incredibly rare side effect from the vaccine. So for people to make an educated decision, they have to be occasionally reminded of, you know, why do we do these vaccines? Well, it's not just for fun. It's to actually keep you from dying from a dreadful disease. And we know that that shifts people's attitudes and intentions. And of course, also reminding people that getting vaccinated is something you're doing for all of us. It's not just that you're being protected. It is also that you're helping to get the pandemic under control. And that is for the benefit of all of us, even people who have health issues that prevent them from getting vaccinated. So that whole herd immunity concept, which I just talked about, and this common good and the sense of community is also very important to communicate when it comes to vaccines.
I know we touched a little bit earlier on social media, and I'm just curious about, you know, what sort of responsibility or role do these social media companies have? You know, there's been so many stories and reports about the psychological aspects and that there weren't enough studies, and they just keep implementing things that they know are I don't know, stirring people up. So what role do they have in changing the way they do things?
Well, I think they do have a role to play, and they have to take responsibility for what they're doing. We know that through the Wall Street Journal, of all places, that Facebook was very aware of the fact that their algorithms on the news feed were polarizing Americans. Most Americans who end up in extremist groups got there through Facebook algorithms, through their recommender system and their news feed. Now, Facebook knows that or knew that. They also knew how to fix it, but they didn't, because it would have interfered with their profits. Now, if they know how to fix it, then I think we can ask them to fix it. This is called democracy. You legislate and you tell people what they have to do for the common good. And that is one of the reasons I'm in Brussels right now, is because I'm working with the European Commission to work out exactly how that might be done and what the best scientific advice is on how you could change social media, make it more conducive to democracy without introducing censorship, which, of course, we all want to avoid.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any tips for our listeners who want to make sure they don't accidentally fall for false information?
Right. Well, I think there's various handbooks I've written: the debunking handbook, the conspiracy theory handbook. The link for that is sks.to/handbooks. sks.to/handbooks. You go there, you'll find a whole bunch of handbooks that are sort of guides for practitioners about how not to be misled and how to avoid conspiracy theories.
All right. Well, thank you so much for
they're free, even though you owe me $1 million for all these answers now.
Yeah. Well, I need to create some viral Facebook posts before I can get that $1 million. But thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate your insight and learning more about misinformation, conspiracy theories, and how we can be better protected. And thank you so much for joining us. I know it's late on your end, and we look forward to following up on the research that you're doing.
Okay,
Stephen Lewandowski is chair in... Thank you. Stephen Lewandowski is chair in cognitive psychology at the University of Bristol. Thank you for joining us to talk about this. We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking today about misinformation and conspiracy theories. Up next, we'll bring in a media expert to talk about what role news organizations and social media companies are playing in all of this. If you have a question or comment for us, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a digital voice message through our app. It's called All In Vox Pop. It's a free app. You can find it in your phone's app store. I'm Miriam Sobel. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Back now to our discussion on misinformation, where it comes from, how it spreads, and what impact it's having on our culture and politics. We're joined now by Jim Shanahan, Dean of the Media School at Indiana University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I'd like to start with how would you generally characterize where we're at right now in terms of how much misinformation is spreading and how much people are believing it?
Well, I think there's a couple of dimensions to that. Number one, we're at a point where the salience of the issue has really been pushed forward, particularly because politics has been so polarized over the last 4 years. And coming out of 4 years of a president where he didn't have really any reluctance to push forth all different kinds of information, it really became kind of a marker of where you are politically to think that something is misinformation or is not misinformation. So you've got that going on, and we'll see to what extent we come out of that, you know, with a new presidency moving forward. I think the other piece of the issue in terms of how many people actually believe misinformation is that it can be hard to know. You know, we have surveys that tell us this, and at our own observatory on social media at IU, we've conducted a lot of these surveys. So we looked at it all throughout the election and saw that numbers of people buying into things that have been called misinformation. So, for instance, you know, the ones that we tracked most carefully in the past election were narratives about Joe Biden's cognitive state, and then one about mail-in voting and whether that would lead to fraud or not. You know, we had rates of people saying either that they thought those narratives were true, either likely true or definitely true, when you add them up, from 40 to 50% and even above. So, which is obviously a pretty high number. When we get into other things, you know, some of the things that really deserve the term conspiracy theories, things like QAnon and so forth, the rates are lower, and the surveys don't tell the entire picture. But I think it's not surprising that people think right now that most people feel right now that we're at sort of a period of unprecedented levels of misinformation in our news ecosystem. I don't know that that's necessarily true when we look back through history, but there's certainly a high level of attention to it, and the debates are very vivid right now.
And that makes me wonder, I mean, have these problems of misinformation gotten worse in recent years, or was it just in the past it was a lot more difficult to know what people were believing and talking about because people weren't doing that online?
I think the online piece makes it much more visible, or audible, or both. But yeah, I mean, we need to point out that conspiracy theorizing is nothing new in American culture. We can see examples back all the way back to our colonial history. Some of these narratives have been very, you know, durable over the years. But think back of all the different conspiracy, you know, we call them now conspiracy theories that are out there, whether it was about the Illuminati or, you know, anti-communist conspiracies or anti-Semitic ones or anti-Catholic ones. I mean, that list could go on for a very long time. In days before social media arrived, there were other places for these theories to be disseminated and circulated. The current, you know, for instance, concerns with QAnon emerged out of a longstanding sort of kind of patriot, you know, ideology, if you will. And those could be heard, like when I was growing up, for instance, in 70s, 80s, you could hear them on shortwave radio, or you could hear them in, you know, or publications that were circulated in various ways. So they did tend to be in media that were not, you know, what we now call mainstream media. And yeah, for sure, social media have foregrounded those to some extent.
And speaking of sort of things that spread really quickly, during this pandemic, there were so many, I don't even know if I want to use the word interesting, but very strange things spread about COVID-19. And, you know, I'm wondering, is that because people were in this sort of a lockdown and it was a way to have some kind of control over their situation by spreading this kind of stuff? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, COVID-19 was ripe ground, you know, for misinformation, obviously. Some researchers started referring to what they called the infodemic, you know, which is basically a epidemic of misinformation. Again, keep in mind, though, you know, with something like vaccination, for instance, we've had anti-vaccination narratives going back as far as I can remember. And we're seeing some of that now, of course, when vaccination is becoming so important. But yeah, you know, high levels of fear, uncertainty, combined with our politically polarized environment. And then, you know, I think what really amped it up was that you had Trump saying basically that COVID-19 was nothing to be worried about. It would be done by Easter and so forth. That then attached an ideological sort of mandate to it. So if you were supporting Trump to some degree, or even if you weren't a huge Trump supporter, but you wanted to, you were identifying to some degree right of center, there was a buy into that. And so these polarizations move people very quickly on and off these stories. And so perhaps it was inevitable that COVID-19 would become the magnet for this sort of thing. But yeah, you know, again, often building on kinds of narratives that have been out there before the arrival of the event itself.
And how much of a role, you mentioned former President Trump, how much of a role do you think he played in making this more mainstream, I guess?
A big role, I think. You know, I don't think there's any doubt about that. And we can see that simply in if we look at if we look at patterns of ways information is disseminated through social media, you know, we can look at network diagrams and things like that and see that the Trump Twitter account, just to pick one example, was a huge hub for that information or that misinformation, you know, and arguably perhaps the most powerful source for it. Not that he was necessarily inventing each and every theory that got put out there, but either explicitly supporting the theory or kind of failing to discount the theory would be another rhetorical move by him. You know, so while I'm not saying it's wrong or right, you know, which can be sort of a winking, I think, kind of move on Twitter. Yeah, I mean, it would be hard to deny the importance of his role.
And where do you think people are getting their information from these days? I mean, I know there's a lot through social media. Is that becoming the new trend where people are preferring to consume their information that way?
I don't think that's the only way, but I mean, we've seen, you know, leaving the question of misinformation and disinformation aside for the moment, obviously there's been moves away from what, you know, we would consider traditional legacy mass media sources. This has now gone on, you know, since the 80s and 90s, really, with the changes that we saw in television news, with the arrival of cable, obviously, which came in the 80s and then the 90s, and then social media coming later on. You know, obviously huge impacts on traditional sources of news, whether that was your local television news, your network television news, your local newspaper, or your more regional or national newspapers. Those all had huge Those all had to respond in huge ways to what social media were doing. And so, yeah, definitely, you know, there are, you know, for students that we teach who have grown up in the new media ecosystem, if you ask them a question like how many of you, you know, let's say read a local newspaper on a daily or semi-daily basis. I used to do that survey in my class every year with incoming students. And it went down each and every year to the point where now, you know, you don't need to ask that question anymore. And so we do have a lot of questions to ask and answer about the quality of the news that we're getting in that new kind of news ecosystem that we have.
And I wonder, I mean, what you're saying now about students not consuming as much, I guess, like local news and local papers. I wonder if part of that is the delay for a lot of these sort of legacy organizations to jump on board with technology. And so, I mean, for myself, sometimes I go to these websites. I'm like, it's so clunky. There are so many pop-ups. Like, it's just, it's not appealing.
Yeah. It's frustrating, actually. Now, I'm an old, you know, I'm a boomer, so we could throw that out there. And and used to reading things, I guess, is the best way I could put it. So I don't know how much of this is just me being grumpy, but my real feeling is that there is a danger when more of our news is either of the cable news variety, which is a lot of people expressing opinions and yelling at each other, or in the social media environment, where again there's, you know, where things are so foreshortened. And we see, you know, we see what happens then in these environments, people's willingness to attack each other, to make very broad moral pronouncements, you know, the things that are now called cancel culture and all that kind of stuff. Not that we didn't have forms of that again in our history. I don't want to suggest that social media is something necessarily brand new. It is a form of human communication, and there are wonderful things that we can do within it too. But yeah, I mean, there is a worry about, you know, we used to talk about, oh, it's a 24-hour news cycle. You know, that was when cable came around, and now it's like a news cycles go in seconds, you know, in minutes. And so yeah, it's very confusing, I think, for everyone, especially for those of us trying to study the impacts of it.
What are your thoughts on the term fake news and how that's kind of become this new term? Do you think it's changing with its definition, or it's just kind of this arbitrary thing people throw around?
Fake news, the coiner of that was Trump, if I'm not mistaken, you know, 5-6 years ago. And so it was literally the decision to attack news for his base mainly, you know, and to repeat that over and over and over again. So, you know, it's interesting you asked that. I mean, fake news, conspiracy theories, misinformation, these are terms that we use now for things that have been around for quite a while. There were periods in the history of journalism, you know, yellow journalism, or, you know, we can go back through our even just U.S. history if we want, and see plenty of times when the media, whether it was newspapers or what have you, were extremely partisan, extremely political. We could perhaps argue that they were always that way. Are we thinking there was sort of a golden age of objective journalism that we're somehow missing? I think there was a little bit, actually, the feeling more when I was growing up that things were a little more centrist in terms of how news was done. So, fake news. I'm not sure if that particular hashtag is running out of steam just yet, as we now get to ways that people in the news business who want to credit something or discount it. You know, the term you'll hear is, well, that's a baseless accusation, or that's false, or, you know, journalists much more willing to say things are false, literally false. And of course, that came out of the Trump period as well. But now you see it on both sides of the ideological aisle for news, to where you'll hear that just as often from, let's say, Fox News as you would from CNN.
Well, how would you rate media coverage so far that you've seen tackling conspiracy theories and misinformation? Do you think they're doing a good job of reporting on this area, or are there some mistakes that they should look into?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I think whenever we try and generalize about the media, we're lumping a lot of things together. So I think, you know, overall, I'm interested in the idea that people are being sensitized to the issue of conspiracy theories. I've been teaching courses on it for a while now. So for my own students, I want them to know about these things. And we go from the silly ones, you know, like the Paul is dead conspiracy theory and, you know, pop culture things and all that, up to the more serious ones like climate denialism and now, of course, COVID and what's happened in the election. So I personally felt it was very important for students to know about these things and to have some sensitization to the fact that not everything you hear, you know, or see on your phone is necessarily true. I think, especially after the events of January 6th at the Capitol, where the images were so vivid, and that attack was, you know, so clearly in evidence for the American people, there was a tendency then to take something like QAnon and get really, really fearful about it. And you started to hear suggestions like, do we need a domestic terrorism law? Should we change communications regulations because of this internal enemy, you know, this very dangerous internal enemy? And I think when we get into that kind of rhetoric, the rhetoric of the internal enemy is sometimes when we then turn away from our concern for other, you know, press freedoms and civil liberties and things like that. And so, you know, it's difficult to know with something like QAnon exactly how many of them there are, if you know what I mean. So surveys have ranged all over the place. It went from something early in the election to where very few people knew the specific tenets of the QAnon theory, you know, the Satanism and all that, to later in the election where it was being portrayed as, oh, the entire country has gone crazy, you know. And the reality is somewhere between that. So I do think there are ways that we need to be, you know, moderate in our discussion of these issues. And when and until we really have better ideas of just how many folks are adherent to those particular theories. And, you know, surveys can tell us so much. It's really forensic work that's needed to do the rest, whether that be from the FBI or others.
And really quick, we have about 30 seconds left. What is a tip you can give for our listeners on how to, I guess, make sure that what they're consuming is accurate?
Well, check it. You know, it's like reading the label, I suppose, on what you're eating and so forth. I recommend, you know, dialing back from some of the media that we've talked about earlier and doing more reading. You know, shows like yours are nice because it's people having a longer chance to talk with each other. We're not getting overly excited one way or another about the issue. There are so many news sources out there, and it's not hard to dial away from your normal news source, whatever that would be, and see what, if you will, another source is saying or what another side might be saying. So it's common sense advice, but easy to follow.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Jim Shanahan is Dean of the Media School at Indiana University. Jim, thanks for joining us. Our producers are Drew Dodlin, Micah Yason, and Tim Brooks. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. Tune in tomorrow for a conversation on autism in Indiana. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.